Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends, students, and allies scattered across the planet, and anyone else who cares or dares to listen. This is your navigator, John Lash, recording on the last day of July, 2013. Nav briefing number 79, and the title is Mama Teach Manners. Now, I'm doing this nav briefing as a kind of fill-in and a conclusion of the 70s series with reference to Mama Teach, and that is to say, with reference to the particular instructions of Tantra Mother. Right now, we are still in the shift of Tantra Mother, and if I look at my lunar calendar, I can see that we're approaching the first day of fall, and we are in, I would say, well, we're a little bit beyond the hinge. So that puts us in the 23rd day of the Vajrayogini shift. And I thought it would be appropriate, in keeping with the meaning of the hinge, which is a solution, to return to the extraordinary topic of Mama Teach. Nevertheless, I want to say before I begin that I have the Aretic proposition resonating strongly in my mind. It appears that some of you do as well. And I need to follow up as soon as possible with some further indications and clarification of the aretic proposition. In fact, at the end of the last briefing, when I stated the aretic proposition, I did not state it in an entirely correct manner. There is a glitch or error, if you will, in the syntax of that statement. And some of you may have caught that. So in the next briefing, number 80, I will return directly to the aretic proposition, go through that again, and I will also go through one more time the procedures for the third practice of mirroring, the practice for flexing the third attention. But right now, as I said, considering the urgency of the moment, I'd like to return to the instructions of Mama Teach, and to reiterate some points that I've already made, as well as to add some new material. You might be interested to know about the weather here and how things have been going since Sunday. It is now Wednesday here. On Sunday and Monday, I had the two vulture auguries, as described. Yesterday, I woke up. Tuesday, I woke up about 9 in the morning, I walked out, and once again there was the same crystal clear sky, a cloudless dome. I think they must be setting some kind of record here for clear skies. I was a bit overwhelmed, to tell the truth, on Tuesday morning. Coming to the subject of the third attention is pretty wild. It's pretty wild. And reaching the aretic proposition is extremely wild. And so during those 2 days, Sunday and Monday and into Tuesday, as I was immersed in that material, if you wish to call it that, I could also feel, in the way that the Nahual feels things, how close I was to pushing the envelope to the limit of pushing the envelope. And it's a given, as you can well imagine. It's a given in the Nahual's world to fluctuate pretty closely on the border between the tonal and the Nahual or sometimes to be more in the Nahual than the tonal, to be in two worlds at once. The experience of being in two worlds at once is one of tension. It's not an unpleasant tension. It's not an anxious tension. But there is a certain kind of tension, and it can be excruciating. And for me, that tension broke on Tuesday. I stood there with my jaw hanging down at 9:30 in the morning, wondering if I would have a third vulture apparition that day. But energetically speaking, I just couldn't handle it. So I came up to my little writing room, my nav deck upstairs, inside, closed it off so it was dark and cool, and I lay down on the tiles. I would have gone out and laid down on the earth, and I would have preferred to have a couple of naked women laying on top of me. It was too hot, however, to go down, to go outside, and the earth around where I live is very, very hard. It's difficult to find even a small place to lay down on the earth. So I did the second best thing. I came into the dark. It wouldn't have been good for me to be in the sun. I came into the dark and laid down on the tiles here and passed out for about 10 hours, which is what I needed to do to stabilize my hold at the border, at the boundary of the tonal. Lacking at that particular moment the kind of Shakti power that would have grounded me and reintegrated my physical body, I used the darkness and the cool of this room. You see, Shakti force is dark and cool. It can also be, of course, warm and wet, but it's also dark and cool. And that's what I needed at that moment. So I really, I was going around on Sunday and Monday feeling like I was going to faint. I mean, it was so intense to be in the presence, in the obvious and flagrant evidence of the subjective side of this reality, that I was fluttering like a butterfly at moments and felt very near to fainting for about 3 days there. So I dealt with it in that way. I must say that today the weather is lovely. There's a breeze, which is kind of warm and cold breeze, warm and cool, quite interesting. And there is a little bit of cloud activity in the sky, but it remains in that uncanny calm. There's an uncanny calm that's been sitting over this place for about 10 days now. Also, I just want to note that while on Monday evening, I did see one airplane at 8:43 in the evening, which I took to be a Malaga-Casablanca flight, I saw no airplane Tuesday. Well, obviously not, because I was sleeping most of the day. But when I came out at 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock, there were still 3 hours of daylight, and I observed the sky closely all evening, not one single airplane. So make what you will of that. A couple of other details here before proceeding. Two small corrections referring back to the series of talks I did in my travelogue from Belgium. I referred to the husband of Mary Pinchot Meyer, that's spelled M-E-Y-E-R, so it could be pronounced Mayer, I suppose, as Court, but his name was Cord, C-O-R-D, Meyer. And he was a high-placed official in the CIA and one of those top five, as I believe I mentioned, the top five who have been shown to be instrumental in arranging the assassination of JFK. You can find his lovely wife by an image search on the internet. Just put in Mary Pinchot-Meyer, P-I-N-C-H-O-T, one of the great heroines of our time. And also I said that I had gone with Robert Beauval to his sister's house. That's not true. I went to his wife's sister's house with him, his sister-in-law's house. Oh, by the way, right after I posted the little travelogue piece on My Dinner with Geoffroy, a crew member sent me a link to a New York Times article online describing the Delphine Boel scandal in Belgium. And as I understand from Geoffroy, Delphine has debts of about 32 million euros. And so there's money involved here, and she's going for a DNA game in the court system. No one knows how that will play out. Anyway, it's kind of an inside joke in Belgium because, well, everyone now knows that Delphine was the daughter of the king by Sibylle de Celles de Longchamp. It's also widely known in the country that the second son of the king, Laurent, has a different father than the king. So all that may come out in the wash, and who knows if it does, who knows what it would do. I think it's extremely remarkable coincidence, or rather a remarkable coincidence, that at the same moment that that genetic and hereditary scandal is playing out in Belgium, the world saw the birth of another, quote, royal heir, unquote, in England, very close to the 21st of July as well. And all of that, of course, is a huge theater. But what it does prove, I would say, what it does indicate are two things. First, it indicates the degree to which the average mind of the human animal can be captivated by the idea of royalty and royal or noble bloodlines. Secondly, it indicates that this scheme of nobility and privilege may be unraveling before our eyes. That would be a wonderful prospect to consider. Certainly, the world or life on this planet, as it could be in a fair and safe society, would require conditions that would allow the thriving of the anthropos, I should say, would require the complete dismantling of this immense mechanism of royalty and hereditary wealth and privilege. So who knows, that may also be part of the archontic structure that is coming down in the 3 years of initialization of correction. Finally, as a last item before I begin, I'd like to read a short letter I just received this morning. I've received some vivid responses to the subject of the eretic proposition and the mirroring exercises. And I would also like to point out that I did speak of happiness recently, didn't I? That's pretty remarkable coming from yours truly. Happiness is a component in Sophia's correction. Probably many of you already realized that and took it on board long before I spoke of it. But here is a message from someone in North Carolina, USA, relative to the subject of happiness. May I begin with an expression of deep gratitude to the main Turton for sharing Gaia Sophia's story. From the moment I heard it, its truth and beauty has been flowing like an electric shock through my mind and body. Since first hearing her story, I have been eager to learn more. With great pleasure and wonderment, I have been going through all manner of material on metahistory and diaspora. With reference to NAV Briefing 76, I was deeply struck by your statement regarding humanity's epitaph, perished for failure to observe beauty. Truth has struck again upon hearing those words, and a swell of emotion surged from within. Those words have crystallized the error that blinds the sight and confuses the mind. The simple act of stopping to look, listen, perceive the beauty that Gaia surrounds us with is solution. All errors can be corrected from this simple yet profound act. I thank you for stating it so clearly. As in this briefing, you spoke of human happiness, and I wanted to share an instructive dream I had at the beginning of Tantra Mother's shift. In this dream, I was repeatedly shown that happiness is a current that emanates from the earth and flows continuously across the landscape. I was shown children playing and chasing this current around in joyous laughter. This current is always present and only requires that one tune oneself to its presence to receive its effect. I am deeply grateful for this dream and to you, John, for helping me to observe beauty. Signed, in love with her story, Nestor. Well, thank you, Nestor. It's wonderful to have a Nestor on board the mothership as well as in the Kalika party. Some of you who read Castaneda many years ago will remember that one of the apprentices in the Nahual's party was called Nestor. Remember that? Nestor and Pablito. So now we have a Nestor in the Kalika war party. And that is a great thrill for me. So there is one response to the topic of happiness, to which I plan to return again and again over the next few months. So, returning to Mama Teach, let's recall the call sign for Vajrayogini. Remember that using channel 16 involves sending a call sign, which is a simple way of keying yourself subliminally to a direction of your thoughts and a direction of your intentions as formulated in thought and in inner subvocal language. You can actually direct your thought into the Shakti cluster to channel 16 by using the call sign appropriate. Until just recently, until this shift of Vajrayogini, I had never considered that each Dakini or Mahavidya may have her own call sign, and I still am considering it. I really don't know if each of them does or does not, or if it's necessary. But it was most remarkable to have the call sign for Tantra Mother revealed as VJY651. Now, as I explained, there's a mudra that goes with the call sign. You use the mudra and the call sign simultaneously. The mudra is a gestural tool that actually also configures your NLP. You probably know about mudras and how mudras work and the significance of mudras in Buddhism and Tibetan Tantra and Hinduism, for that matter. And the power of mudras is well attested by many people through the ages. I just want to point out that the mudra for Mama Teach involves putting your thumb and index finger together at a right angle so that you pinch them so that the nails almost touch and you form a right angle between the joint of the thumb and the first joint of the thumb and the first joint of the 1, 2, 3 joints of the index finger. And then you are left with three fingers outstanding, of course, and you're looking at the palm of your hand. Just hold it up like that and look right at the palm of your hand. You'll find that the palm of your hand sort of puckers or dips in. Hold your three fingers straight and separate them. Then you subvocally pronounce the call sign. VJY, that is the three fingers. Turn your hand, look at the back of the three fingers, 651. Another thing I'd have you note when you perform that mudra of the call sign is that there is a particular sensation which is absolutely consistent for everyone who does it. This sensation occurs when you open slightly the gap between the thumb and forefinger. So make that mudra, hold your hand about a foot in front of your face, and look right at the palm of your hand. Remember, hold your three fingers equally apart, and then very slowly separate the joint of the index finger from the thumb. Make a little gap there. As you do that, what do you feel? Stop, close the gap, open the gap again. Keep your fingers straight, close the gap, open the gap again. What do you feel? What everyone feels immediately is the same thing. You feel a kind of tension goes into the three fingers, don't you? When you open the gap, it throws a kind of tension into the three fingers. Well, the three fingers, of course, are full of blood. And in that blood, there is hemoglobin and iron. And so the three fingers of this mudra, and of all the fingers of all mudras, in fact, are in reality iron-saturated, blood-filled antennas. The mudra of Tantra Mother is an antenna using three fingers as the transmitting device. And the tension that you feel when you slightly gap the mudra is the tension in the antenna. Now remember, and this is a fundamental and inviolable principle of Gayan echo sorcery. Tension translates to intention. When you do a cording, the tension in the lines of the chords carries the intention of the cording. And when you release the cording, it stands there in the tree as a spider web, a chaotic spider web of chords, and the tension of those chords attracts the attention of the Aeon Sophia. Her mind is in the wind, and as her mind surges around the planet, it feels the places where human animals have gathered or accumulated tension. Castaneda called this accumulating personal power. You leave your intention in the tension of according, then Sophia picks it up and it becomes her intention. This is the power sharing arrangement of planetary tantra, right? So when you do the mudra to make the call sign for Tantra Mother, you can actually tune the antenna of the mudra by opening and closing that gap. You can actually feel the tension. What you're feeling really is not just a muscular tension of the fingers as a reaction in some respect to opening the gap, but you're actually feeling the tension of the electromagnetism in those three fingers embedding itself in the electromagnetism of the ambient atmosphere. There is a surface tension in the atmosphere. The weight of that surface tension, by the way, is 16 pounds per square inch upon your flesh. Don't know if you know that. Anyway, that's just a physical or quantitative measure of the tension in the atmosphere. Within that, there is the true tension of the atmosphere, which is an bioelectromagnetic tension. And so that's what you feel when you open the gap And that's called gapping the mudra. Now, what did I say already about the singular traits or aspects of the instruction of Tantra Mother? Well, one thing is that she can reach the NLP networking of your brain at the border of the verbal, pre-verbal experience. So there are neural networks laid down in your brain. There are repetitive systems of synaptic charge and discharge which were formed pre-verbally. And then there were those that were the first systems that were laid down, another layer, as it were, of your neural networking that was laid down as you entered into verbal experience, as you became able to speak. And in the first 2 years of speaking, well, the first 6 months to 2 years, when you speak baby talk, we all speak baby talk, that baby talk is some damn serious talk. Because in fact, that baby talk is a configuration or involves a configuration of your neural networking. The instruction of Tantra Mother is so profound that it can reach and transform and change and liberate you at the level of those neural networks that were laid down at that time, pre-verbally and in the first years of verbal expression. And whenever we say mama teach freedom, mama teach conscience, mama teach manners, it's a wonderful, playful way to remind ourselves that she is accessing that level as mama teach, mama reach pre-verbal level of NLP. Mama teach and mama reach. And it's a wonderful way to put yourself back into that mindset and have the delight and the assurance of knowing that one of the Diamond Sky Dakinis can actually reach you at that level and teach you and liberate your behavior, aka your manners, at that level where they were initially formed. So, mama teach manners, and mama teach undoing of manners. And that's what I'm going to talk about now in regard to the theme of ruthless caring, which is the title of a workshop I did in Santa Fe in October of 1984. Just one more point regarding Tantra Mother before I go back to that material. There is one other outstanding feature of Vajrayogini's instruction that I have failed to mention up until this point. It keeps slipping back somewhere in the discourse. There happens to be a lot coming through the discourse right now. But I would be negligent if I did not point this out. You recall that since the beginning of her shift on July 9th, I spoke of conscience and the absence of conscience. Now, that theme is not a Vajrayogini theme. The theme of conscience and the teaching about the absence of conscience is actually a Matangi teaching. And what had happened was that some months back, during the Matangi shift, I got a glimpse of this teaching. It screamed at me, as these instructions will sometimes do. And I think it was during the end of the last Matangi shift that I found myself contemplating this theme. I found myself in a state of excitation upon the realization, the revelation, that human animals do not intrinsically possess conscience. I was stunned and amazed by the realization at that time that the foundation of moral activity and the discovery of conscience by the human animal depends first and foremost upon admitting the absence of conscience. And so it came to me in a dazzling paradox. I wasn't able to articulate that paradox. I wasn't able to transceive or bring into language what I perceived at that moment to be a Matangi instruction about the absence of conscience. How is it then that it burst forth during the Vajrayogini shift? And in particular, it burst forth at that momentous transition moment, the 7th, 8th, and 9th of July, following the lunar apogee surge in 1 degree Cancer, with Jupiter positioned in the surge. How did it happen that this revelation on the absence of conscience reemerged vividly and became accessible to articulation at the first moment of the Vajrayogini shift? Well, what I understood at that moment, and I was sitting, that was Monday morning, I was sitting upstairs in the Grenier in Belgium. What I realized at this moment was that Mama Teach subs. She not only teaches her own particular lessons, that which is specific to her instruction as a Diamond Sky Dakini, but she can sub for any other teaching. I've been wanting to say this now for 3 weeks, and I have a feeling that some of you might already have glimpsed this. Have some of you found during this period since the 8th or 9th of July that various aspects of other Dakini teachings have been given to you in an elucidated manner? Well, at least one person has. I'll read this little message in the Navigator mail from Jordan. John, I experienced a shock instruction from Shodashi last night. I am confident that this was from my guardian Shodashi and not Mama Teach on shift or Idris still lurking behind the shift's curtains. To tell it as it is, I feel her attention on me. I can feel her glance on me, melting my whole being like a candle left in the sun. This is the first time since I named Shodashi as my guardian that I have felt her attention so powerfully and intimately, or have felt any of the Rakinis or Mahavidyas so intimately for that matter. Deepest regards, Jordan. Now, here's an example that proves exactly what I wish to tell you. And I have a pretty good idea that a number of you as well may have experienced this. Tantra Mother can sub for any other Dakini instruction, like a substitute teacher. Now, in this analogy, the substitute teacher would have to be a polymath, that is, learned or instructed in various areas and subjects. So you could have, for instance, a math teacher who was specialized in math who was a substitute teacher. So the math teacher goes in and subs for the ordinary math teacher who happens to be out for that day. Tantra Mother is a polymath sub teacher. She could go in and sub for the teacher in the geography class, in the science class, in the math class, or in the English literature class. That is to say that in this practice, you can now anticipate during any future Vajrayogini shift, that not only will you be able to transceive her instructions, 651, but also the instructions of any other Dakini or Mahavidya, which she chooses to translate or confer to you, depending on the appropriateness of that instruction in the frame of her overall deconditioning process. One of the roles of Tantra Mother is the deconditioning. Mama teach manners. Mama teach undoing of manners. Mama teach no manners. Mama teach me have no manners. You see? She can teach you to have no manners. What does it mean to have no manners? It means not to be driven by the compulsivity of your own behavior. It doesn't mean that you don't have behavior. It just means that you're free within that behavior to use that behavior as an instrument of expression rather than to be used or driven by it. And this, in fact, this theme that I'm stating right now is more or less the premise of the course that I gave in Santa Fe at the Institute of Creative Mythology in October of 1984. So I called that course Ruthless Caring, Seeing Through Ourselves. And in that course, I took a standard iconographic item from Tibetan Buddhism and converted it into astrological idiom, and from that I converted the astrological idiom into a set of terms that describe six particular forms of behavior, six forms of repetition compulsion, if you will. Now, I'm not going to reiterate entirely the content of that particular seminar. I just want to go over some of the highlights as they are relevant to the GNE and as they are relevant to the instructions of Tantra Mother. The iconographic item I used, of course, is known as the Tibetan Wheel of Life. Now, if you want to know anything about Tibetan Buddhism, just read Foundations of Tibetan Buddhism, Foundations of Tibetan Mysticism by Lama Govinda. That's the only book you need to read. And in that book, you'll find a rather extensive treatment of the Tibetan Wheel of Life. In fact, the image that I reproduced for the flyer of my course is taken from Lama Govinda's book. If you put Tibetan Wheel of Life in a search engine, you'll come up with many images, and one of them from a web page that I'm looking at here illustrates the same illustration, a tracing of a Tibetan temple fresco of Sankar Gompa in Leh, L-E-H, and that is the image from Lama Govinda's book. It's also called the Bhava Chakra. Now let me describe what this iconographic mandala shows. Let's start at the center. It shows a pig, a snake, and a cock. This represents the three poisons. Now, what are the three poisons? Well, you'll have a hard time with that one, my friends, because as a matter of fact, there are dozens of variants of the three poisons found in Tibetan teachings and in Western commentaries on Tibetan Buddhism. Very crudely, I'll refer to the ones I used at that time, which are unacceptable today, by the way. The snake was desire, the cock was hatred, the pig was ignorance. Well, that doesn't fly. And I think you might find, if you consider or take the time to consider some of the definitions given to the three poisons, they don't really apply. So we can blow all that off. but just retain the central idea that somehow the wheel of rebirth, that is to say, of reincarnation, is driven by the flywheel at the center. And the flywheel consists of three components which are alternatively and consecutively consuming and driving each other: the pig, the snake, and the cock. Whatever they used to be doesn't matter anymore. Whatever they used to be called doesn't matter anymore. Whatever generations of Tibetan monks have learned about them doesn't matter anymore. Because in the instruction of Vajrayogini today, these three forces, the flywheel of the cycle of rebirth, are the three vectors of pain: the pain of abandonment, the pain of loss, and the pain of betrayal. Now, do you want to correlate them to these three animals? You can if you wish. How would you do that? I don't know. Let me take a guess. I would say that loss goes to the snake, particularly to the constrictor snake, because loss is a constriction. It strangles and constricts you when you have lost something, if you succumb to that loss. I would say that betrayal goes to the cock. One of the most common forms of betrayal is, of course, cuckolding or sexual betrayal. The cock is a sexual image. Also, the cock stands on the dung heap and sings in the morning. And if you've ever have a rooster in the neighborhood, you know that you can't ignore the rooster calling in the morning, the rooster calling at the rise of the sun. Neither can you ignore betrayal. Betrayal is like the call of the rooster. It wakes everyone up. Everyone sees betrayal. Everyone sees your betrayal. You can't hide betrayal. It shows on your face. It shows in your manner. Finally, I would say that abandonment is the pig, because the pig is connected in a negative sense with a kind of obtusity. And abandonment is due to an obtusity of the human heart. In the original correlations, it's moha, which means an ignorance or obtusity. The immensity of the human heart and the human capacity for love is immeasurable. And one of the principles of love is that if you love, you love totally. There is no other way to love but totally. But there is an ignorance and obtusity in the human mind that leads to the belief, to the illusion, that you can love partially, that you can withhold, that you can measure out love. And that ignorance leads to the abandonment of that which is loved. Because the only way to love anything is to love it totally. And if you don't love it totally, you're abandoning it. So I don't know how those correlations hold up. It's not really that important to make direct point-by-point parallels between the original iconography and the syntax that is current in Vajrayogini's instruction. What's more important is to see the schema, to see the overall construction of the Tibetan Wheel of Life. So let's move outward now from the flywheel or central core, which is a tri-kaya or three-body format, to the six realms. Six realms are considered in a literal sense to be the realms of rebirth in Tibetan Buddhism traditionally. The realms where the immortal consciousness can be reborn. And those realms are realms of the gods, the titans, the humans, the animals, the ghosts, and the demons. So, traditionally, Tibetans take those characterizations, those categories, very literally. So, they maintain that the primordial and unconditioned consciousness of the universe, which belongs to all of us, can be reborn in the God realm, or in the Titan realm, or exceptionally in the human realm, which is only one of the six realms, and that those who are reborn as human beings can also be reborn as animals, ghosts, and demons, sometimes called hungry ghosts. Well, there you go. That is the old style interpretation of this mandala. What I endeavored to do in the course I gave in Santa Fe was to convert that language into a more current and user-friendly jargon. And so I said, look, let's not take it literally. Let's just say that any one of these six realms can be manifested in human behavior, that they are just categories of behavior. You can even call them games. You can say the Titan game, the Hungry Ghost game, the Animal game, the Human game. So, the advantage of this mandala as a teaching tool, and it is an extraordinary tool in that respect, is that it can show you immediately how to perceive all human behaviors in terms of six games or six styles of behavior. And, of course, because I was teaching astrology at the time, I linked it into astrology in a simple and elegant manner by saying that there are 12 signs, but these signs are set up in polaric opposites. So you don't just have Gemini, you have Gemini Sagittarius. You have Cancer Capricorn. You have Aries Libra. If you consider the polaric opposites of these 12 signs, which are styles of personal behavior, it's the best way to describe an astrological sign. We're not talking here, by the way, about the constellations and the real sky constellations, bull, twins, snake tamer, scales, and so forth. We're talking about the starless tropical signs, okay? Your sun sign is simply a style of behavior. You have a Gemini style of behavior. I have a Sagittarius style of behavior. Someone else has a Libra style of behavior. Someone else has a Virgo style of behavior, or Virgo, as I prefer to say. So, it's a simple feat of transformation to take the 12 astrological signs or styles, convert them to six polaric units, and correlate those six polaric units to the six realms. And this is easy to do. So, you have, for instance, the realm of the gods, that is Virgo Pisces. You have the realm of the Titans, that is Gemini Sagittarius. You have the realm of the humans, that is Taurus Scorpio. You have the realm of the animals, Leo Aquarius. The realm of the hungry ghosts, Cancer Capricorn. And the realm of the demons, Aries Libra. What I showed in the course of the seminar was that regardless of all the other traits and attitudes that might be associated with the astrological signs, which is, of course, a huge study in itself, regardless of that, you have an immediate and user-friendly tool to identify behavior by reducing it to the six realms. So, okay, so what are you? Oh, so you're an Aquarius. Okay, so you're playing the animal game. Your behavior is characteristic of the animal game. You're incarnated in the realm of the animals, okay? So what are you? Oh, you're a Gemini. Well, if you're a Gemini or a Sagittarius, then you're in the realm of the Titans, and you're playing the Titan game. And so what I did in that seminar was to name the games. Bear in mind that at that time, which is going on to 30 years now, I didn't know that the highest instruction of Kala Tantra
can be achieved by putting any event or experience into a gaming metaphor. Nevertheless, that's exactly what I did in this seminar. Now, what do I mean by naming the game? Well, simply that I provided a syntax or language for each of these six games. Now, I would warn you that what I attempted at that time was highly, highly reductionist. The behavior of any single human animal is complex. And that behavior, that is to say, your manners, mama teach manners, is comprised of a wide range of different attitudes and approaches and styles. And so the very attempt to reduce human behavior to six games is, in one sense, a monumental challenge and an impossible one, perhaps. But a certain degree of success might be possible. And in fact, this was one of the most successful seminars that I ever gave. It's remarkable that I have the original portfolio here in front of me that I distributed to participants in that seminar, which was a 2-day seminar at my studio on La Vereda off Palace Avenue in Santa Fe. The old La Vereda, not the new one up above. 707 East Palace Avenue. So, let's look at the names of the games and see how they hold up. What are the names? Well, the game of the gods, Virgo Pisces, is self-glorification. The game of the titans, Gemini Sagittarius, is self-appeasement. The game of humans, which is Taurus Scorpio, is self-validation. The game of the animals, Leo Aquarius, is self-mystification. The game of the ghosts, or hungry ghosts, which is Cancer Capricorn, is self-aggrandizement. And the game of the demons, which is Aries Libra, is self-justification. And so with each of those tags, as it were, which is each of those behavioral tags, behavioral labels, I included a short description. And I don't know what the value of those descriptions would be today or if they would hold up. I'm not suggesting that we go back and pick them up and consider them to be, in some way, paraphrases of Vajrayogini instruction. I certainly would not do that. They may have a certain archaic value. They may have a certain current value. So I will type them out and include them in some upcoming material that I provide to the crew. And you make of them what you like. I'll just read one example for now to give you a little bit of the flavor of these characterizations that I developed about 30 years ago. Let's take the realm of the hungry ghosts, Cancer Capricorn. That is to say that all those born in the sign Cancer or Capricorn play this game of self-aggrandizement, but they play it in different ways. The Cancer style of playing self-aggrandizement is different from the Capricorn style, and those are nuances that I discussed and developed in the course of the seminar. Here are my notes on the self-aggrandizement game of Cancer Capricorn. Sometimes played in the form of impoverishment or denial, played via emotionalism, psychic tactics, mental and material ambitions. Now, when it is transformed, this game becomes skill in discoveries, enrichment through giving, motive sharing, and true collaborations. So, what I did with each game is I characterized, as it were, the syndrome of that game, the behavioral syndrome, Mama Teach Manners. And then I characterized how that game would be transformed into a skill of expression, into a liberated form of expression. And The wonderful feature of this particular seminar was, of course, that I had the opportunity to directly verify these characterizations with the people in the seminar simply by referring to their sun sign styles. So when I was giving my little riff on the Titans and the game of self-appeasement, often achieved through enormous contradictions, played out via impossible demands, grandiose agonies, and adventure seeking, which becomes a skill in applying ideas, knowledge of life strategies, and enlightening acts. When I made this little peremptory characterization, then I called upon those people in the attending the seminar who were in that game, and then I discussed it with them and to see if it related. In other words, I had an immediate reality check, and I could develop and refine the characterizations in dialogue with the people in the seminar. Now let's return for a moment to the Tibetan Wheel of Life, to that teaching mandala or iconographic image. We haven't yet arrived at the full scope of that image. It consists of three components. The core of three vectors, pig, snake, and cock. The division of the six realms, or behavioral syndromes. And then, in the outermost rim of the wheel, there are 12 small images. And these 12 images represent the links in the chain of interdependent originations. Some people say links in the chain of rebirth. Interdependent origination is the standard term, okay? What that means is that the primordial enlightened consciousness, which is at the basis of all consciousness, mistakes itself and falls into a set of interlinking behaviors that bind it into an ignorance of its own nature. That is called the chain of interdependent originations. And the Tibetan Wheel of Life illustrates the 12 links, which are called nidanas, by 12 particular images. And it also names these 12 links. So where did I go from there in the seminar? Well, I said, look, in addition to placing yourself in a game or realm, you can also identify the key compulsion in your behavior with one of these links, because there are 12 links, there are 12 signs, okay? So, if you're a Cancer, then that's the fourth link, which is called name and form. If you're a Scorpio, it's the eighth link, which is called craving or Trishna, and so forth and so on. So, of course, I was using all the Sanskrit terms, avidya, samskara, vijnana, marama. But I was translating them as best I could and converting them into something that would make sense to people, something that would be user-friendly and have an immediate applicability. I did my best. One of the things I did was I paraphrased the standard, rather bulky, cumbersome, and not very helpful language for the chain of interdependent originations into a modern paraphrase, and it's listed here for what it's worth. Modern paraphrase, JLL, 1980. Starting out with Aries. Aries is inattention. Taurus, habit. Gemini, interpretations. Cancer, identification. Leo, obsession. Virgo, need. Libra, seeking. Scorpio, suffering. Sagittarius, importance. Capricorn, limitation. Aquarius, redundance. Pisces, inertia. And so the recitation, as it were, of the litany of the chain goes like this. On inattention depends habit. On habit depends interpretations. On interpretations depend identification. On identification depends obsession. On obsession depends need or inadequacy. On need depends seeking. On seeking depends suffering. On suffering depends importance. On importance depends limitation. On limitation depends redundance. On redundance depends inertia. On inertia depends inattention. And here you go again. Now, what is the value of all this jargon, all this language? It's like fills up like it's like a fruit bowl. After a while, your mind is like a fruit bowl, isn't it? Well, the value of it, such as it was then, such as it may be, is this. Every single human animal, of course, exhibits these factors. The factor of inattention, that is, not paying attention to things, just the nidana of Aries. The factor of habit, the factor of need or inadequacy, the factor of importance. But it might be useful if you chose one of them as your pet factor. And how would you know which one is your pet factor? That is the one that is the most compelling link in the 12-fold chain? Well, it's the one that corresponds to your sign, which in my case is importance. If you're a Capricorn, it's limitation. If you're an Aquarian, it's redundance. Okay? And what I found in the active part of that seminar, because it was intensely interactive, was that these correlations and these terms clicked. They did work. They did have a certain value, but I want to advise you, my friends and students and crew members, that it is a limited value. It is a provisional and limited system because you easily get swamped in the jargon and the language working in this genre. And that, of course, is one of the great problems of astrology, is that it is excessively verbal. And the naming of things can take you away from the dynamic of your own experience. So that is a risk. So I'm not going to propose by any means, as I close off this particular briefing, that you go back and review all of this material in this seminar and that we would recover and use this material. I don't propose that at all. I'm simply going over the seminar as background reference to bring your attention to the instruction of Tantra Mother today. Tantra Mother instructs in all these behaviors and syndromes. And she does it in a free-form manner. She does it however it's appropriate. Tantra Mother has the capacity to interpolate her instruction easily and freely into your everyday thinking and your everyday circumstances and situations. Unlike some of the other Dakinis and Mahavidyas, whose instruction is rigorous and high velocity syntax, and whose instruction requires a great deal of internal concentration, the instruction of Mama Teach is user-friendly. And it is something that comes to you in the current of your day-to-day experiences in real time. That is, regarding the particular instructions of the number six, which is the six realms. And so, today, I would say that what I called at that time Avalokiteshvara's system of the six realms is really present as a meltdown. It's all been melted down and is now reissued in the vivid and direct genre of planetary tantra. So it's remarkable that I associated the constellation of the crab at that time with the Tibetan god of compassion, Avalokiteshvara. It's remarkable because it would appear to me now that Avalokiteshvara is in fact Mama Teach. I was really impressed at that time in my life by something that I heard about Avalokiteshvara. This is an element of Tibetan folklore as much as it is a factor in the teachings of Tibetan Buddhism. It is said that Avalokiteshvara looks down upon all the six realms. He observes the capture of human animals to compulsive cycles of behavior following the chain of independent originations. On ignorance depends habit, on habit depends interpretations, and so forth. And being a god of compassion, the female equivalent being Kuan Yin, Avalokiteshvara wishes to release human beings from these samsaric and delusional syndromes of behavior. Well, fortunately, he is equipped with 1,000 arms. And I've even been in a temple in Japan where there is a statue of Avalokiteshvara with 1,000 arms. I think it's in Nara. So, how does Avalokiteshvara perform the act of liberation of all sentient beings from the wheel of rebirth? In each hand of these 1,000 arms is an eye. In the palm of Avalokiteshvara's 1,000 hands are 1,000 eyes. And any time that a human being finds himself or herself in a difficult situation, caught up and captured by these behavioral syndromes, and seeing no way out, Avalokiteshvara puts out a hand. And that individual is then able to look through the eye in the palm of his hand and see the solution to that situation. This is a legend, this is a quaint and charming little fairy tale about Avalokiteshvara. I think it's an appropriate place to conclude this briefing because it illustrates, for our purposes now, exactly how Mama Teach provides for her children. There is always a solution. There is always a way out of the repetition compulsion of human behavior, out of double-bind situations. Each of these pairs of signs represents a double bind. I'll also include that language in the written text that I'm extracting from this course. You get caught in a double bind. And the way out of that double bind is always immediately accessible. One of the features of planetary tantra and the tantric path in general is the instantaneousness of it. You don't work your way through things in tantra. If you get through it at all, you get through it more or less instantaneously. If you fall back into working through things, you're not really in the practice of tantra at the optimal level. At the optimal level, you don't work through anything. You just turn everything immediately. And that is called, as I've said before, the city of Sutaka. The city meaning occult power. Sutaka, S-U-T-A-K-A, means rendering, like you render fat into tallow for candles, or you render butter into ghee. Rendering is the tantric technique. And Tantra Mother teaches her children rendering. The solutions have to be ready-made. There's no time left in Kali Yuga for therapy and long years of working through things. There's no time to work through all these things. There's no time to work through the human condition. You break through the human condition. You don't work through it. And Mama Teach is often the sublime, compassionate, and overseeing presence of those breakthroughs. So finally, just my comment on the title I gave to that course, Ruthless Caring. I made a point at the time to talk about ruthlessness, which, believe me, was not a popular idea in the New Age environment of Santa Fe then and probably still isn't. But the point I wanted to make by giving the seminar that title was that when you see through yourself, you acquire the ability to care for others, to care about others, to exhibit to them the same compassion that you exhibit to yourself as an animal caught in behavioral syndromes, but you do it ruthlessly. You don't practice what Chögyam Trungpa warned about. You don't practice idiot compassion. So the compassion that comes through seeing these games and being able to spot these behavioral games like that, to nail them right on the spot and to break through them, is a ruthless compassion. And it's the only kind that works, because it's the kind of compassion, like Teflon, that doesn't stick to anything. You don't want to practice a compassion that attaches you to the object of that compassion. That is not ruthless compassion. That is not ruthless caring. So that's why I gave that little twerk or twitch to the title of the talk. Now, there's a lot more to say about 5-6-1. Remember, one refers to the supreme teaching of Vajrayogini, release from pretending. Five refers to her special initiation of the five-skull crown, of which I have a lot to say. Obviously, I can't pack it into this briefing. And six refers to the six realms and to the entire agenda of behavioral profiling that I just presented. As a matter of fact, additional to this teaching of the six from Mama Teach, I find that the teaching of the five is deeply powerful and relevant right now. The teaching of the five skull crown. And as you can observe, if you pull up the Tibetan Wheel of Life in an image search, there it is, looking you right in the face. The traditional representation of the Wheel of Life shows it being held by a wrathful demon. And so you see the head of the wrathful demon peering over the top of this design. And sure enough, what is the wrathful demon wearing? The five-skull crown. So that's another subject. I don't know when I'm going to get to that. I have about eight subjects lying now end to end as I contemplate where to cram them into NAB briefings, which is not an easy, not an easy puzzle to solve right now. But I'm pedaling as fast as I can, and so I'll draw this briefing to a close and pick up in NB number 80 the more pertinent and central topic of the eretic proposition.